Well, good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and it's wonderful to have such a full house for this lecture, Simon Winchester on Atlantic, Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and A Vast Ocean of a Million Stories, our first evening event of the 2011 season. We are, as a library, very pleased to be able to offer an ongoing series of diverse events with authors, scholars, and performers. For a list of our upcoming events, do please pick up a copy of the winter newsletter if you didn't receive it at home, or if you're new to the library, and I'm happy to know there are some new members who came tonight. And the newsletter is available at the front desk. We also publish everything on the website, too, so you can also just go to the website. As we begin, may I remind you to take out your cell phones, pagers, anything you have that might ring, buzz, make a noise, and turn it off for the extent of this evening. I want to thank all of our library members who supported us last year for our fall appeal and our spring appeal. We will be acknowledging donors once again in an upcoming issue of Library Notes, our newsletter. The funds are essential to support our day-to-day operations of the library and to make evenings like this one possible. Thank you for your support. We also have the print and audiobook editions of Mr. Winchester's new book for sale this evening in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery. And if you didn't have a chance to purchase one before the event, do so after, and he will be available to sign copies following the event. H.L. Mencken said, "Have you ever watched a crab on the shore crawling backward in search of the Atlantic Ocean and missing? That's the way the mind of man operates." Clearly, Mencken feels that the Atlantic is inconceivably large and the mind of man a little too small or misdirected. But I am quite confident that tonight's speaker, Simon Winchester, is a writer who could get his mind around a topic as large and unmissable as the mighty Atlantic. A London native, Winchester has worked as a geologist and broadcaster, as well as a journalist and author, getting in-depth in places as diverse as Greenland and Uganda before he was the age of 23. He joined the staff of the Guardian newspaper in 1969 and later wrote for the Sunday Times. He's a true citizen of the world. He's covered the turbulent 1970s and 1980s in Ireland, India, and Pakistan, the United States during Watergate, the Falkland Islands during the Argentinian invasion, and Hong Kong, culminating in 12 years covering most of Asia and the Pacific for The Guardian and Condé Nast Traveler. When Hong Kong became Chinese again in 1997, to our good fortune, Mr. Winchester joined us in New York City and focused on writing books. His first bestseller was 1998's The Professor and the Madman, about the creation of the Oxford English Dictionary. He has many other respected and popular titles, many of them here on display, including The Man Who Loved China, about Joseph Needham, A Crack in the Edge of the World, about the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, and Krakatoa. Mr. Winchester was recently made an officer of the Order of the British Empire for services to journalism and literature in 2006. Please join me in a warm welcome to Simon Winchester.
Well, thanks very much indeed. I was just cursing because I didn't know that H.L. Mencken quote, and I just wish I could put it in the book. That sounds as if it's going to be all right. Okay. Well, I'll try and project anyway. Well, this book, as you know from the title, is about the Atlantic Ocean, but it actually was really born on the world's largest ocean, the Pacific, for two reasons. The first being that about 20 years ago, I wrote a book about the Pacific. I was living in Hong Kong at the time, and everyone would say to me, the Pacific is the ocean of the future, and would point to all sorts of statistics about air travel and volume of cargo crossing it and the presence of the Asian tigers, China, Korea, Japan, and whatnot, and said, you really must do a book about this, the ocean of the future. And so I dutifully listened, I drank the Kool-Aid, as it were, and I spent a couple of years crossing. I mean, it was very agreeable to do, the Pacific from, you know, Kamchatka to Chile and from Australia to Alaska and going to all the islands in between, and then wrote a book about called, I think it's there actually, called Pacific Rising, which, and it is astonishing for me to see it because it was a terrible commercial failure. It sold virtually no copies at all. And believe you me, I knew something about commercial failures because in the 1970s, I wrote a book about the American Midwest called American Heartbeat, which was published in 1977 and sold precisely 12 copies. So the Pacific wasn't quite as dire a disaster as that, but it clearly was a disaster. And when we were sort of sitting around licking our wounds and thinking, why had this not sort of captured the imagination? It might have been a dreadful book, but I sort of dismissed that possibility. And we decided that the real reason was that while the Pacific may well be the ocean of the future, what it clearly wasn't, in human terms anyway, was the ocean of the past. Yes, you had Magellan, yes, you had Captain Cook, yes, you had the Polynesian navigations, but apart from that, there wasn't an enormous amount of human history. There weren't too many human stories to tell about the Pacific, and that if you thought about it, the body of water that really was hugely involved with the story of humankind and that could be called the cradle of classical civilization, I suppose, would be the Mediterranean. And if you agreed with that, then it wasn't too much of a hop and a skip and a jump to think that the next door ocean, the Atlantic, could probably be labeled the inland sea of Western civilization. And so I sort of conceived at that idea that at that moment that what I had done was effectively backed the wrong horse back in the, and that one day I could maybe back the right horse and write a book about the Atlantic. But the idea sort of came and went, and it just lingered in the back of my mind. And then the event that actually pushed me over the edge happened about, I suppose, 7 or 8 years ago, but also on the Pacific. I was in Chile, and I was driving on a road that maybe some of you will know, the road from Punta Arenas in the very southern tip of Chilean Patagonia to the Torres del Paine National Park. And it's an extremely bad road. It's mostly gravel and it's rutted, and there are cliffs that you can fall off and cliffs that keep falling on you. And it was just not a very pleasant road. And it was late at night and it was foul weather and I was extremely tired. And I was looking for somewhere to stay, but there are no villages, no nothing, except off to the left there was a little wooden sign which said, pointing to it announced to be Hostería del Río de la Penitencia, which didn't sound desperately promising, but nonetheless, Hostería sort of trumped the word Penitencia. So I turned left and bumped down an even worse road than the one I was on, and was eventually confronted by what looked like an enormous Scottish castle, and with one or two rather dim lights glowing. So I parked the car and went through the rain and hammered on the door, and a elderly functionary opened it, and he allowed us, yes, this was indeed a hotel. They hadn't had a guest for the last six or seven months, they thought, but it had been built indeed by a Scotsman in the 19th century who had set it up as a sheep farm, but nowadays they still farmed, and they farmed the equivalent of the llama down, it was called the Wanaco. And this chap, very enthusiastic, I mean, he was very pleased to find a guest, and he said there was a lot of Wanaco meat in the fridge, and you could very easily make a Wanaco casserole. And so they did. And so 2 hours later, I was sitting in the kitchen with these extremely nice Patagonian people dining on freshly made bread and Wanaco casserole and a bottle of Malbec. And so God was in his heaven, and all was right with the world. And then they invited me to move into the library, which was a huge room much like this, actually, with a great big fireplace, roaring fire, all the books in English and a bottle of whiskey, and I couldn't have been happier. And so I retrieved, not at random, because I went through the books, and I took a slim volume out And I started reading it. It must have been about 10:30, and it so captivated me, this story, which turned out to be all about the Atlantic Ocean, and I'll tell you more about the book later on, that by the time I finished it, the sun was coming up over the Andes. I didn't want to go to bed. I just wanted to finish this wonderful story, and I closed it and trooped off to have a bath and go and have breakfast, and thought, I really now must write a book about the Atlantic Ocean. This vague idea I've had ever since the failure of the Pacific, I should now get to grips with it. And so I sent an email off to the publishers in New York, and I said, I think I'm ready to write a book about the Atlantic. And they said, that's terrific, and issued a contract almost without thinking about it. They didn't require a proposal in any detail, just a book about the Atlantic. Super, they said. So then I had to work out how on earth to write it. Clearly, the one way to write it was not the way I'd written about the Pacific. I had to look for a different structure. And it struck me at first that the model probably could be a biography, because after all, one can think of the Atlantic, I suppose, any body of water as a living thing. It moves, it makes noises, it has moods. And it also has, in the case of the Atlantic, a very well-known moment of birth. We know, I have a sort of geological background, and we know that the Atlantic came into being when Pangaea, I don't want to make this too boringly technical, the one dominating continent of the world, surrounded by Panthalassa, the one then sea in the world, Pangaea split asunder about 190 million years ago, and water started to cascade into the crack between the two, and that was the very beginning of the Atlantic, and then it assumed its sort of S-shaped, sinuous shape that it has today about 45, 50 million years ago. So we know precisely when it was born. I mean, we're talking, of course, in very long periods of time, and I might say that the appreciation of geological time is by some people, is not as considerable as it might be. I was once giving a talk in Kansas City to a group of ladies who lunch, and we were talking about the likelihood of the Yellowstone National Park volcanoes, the volcanoes that created the park, erupting again, which they certainly will do. And indeed, the floor of the Yellowstone River and the lake is rising and falling with a sort of slightly sinister periodicity at this moment, which makes geologists certain that an eruption is coming. And when the eruption happens, it will be a titanic series of volcanic eruptions, which will probably last 100 years or so. And when they're finished, San Francisco and Seattle and Portland and Vancouver and Calgary will be covered with hundreds of feet of dust and ash, and the whole of the northwestern United States and western Canada will be toast or will be history. And everyone in the audience was slightly alarmed about this. And I said, well, don't worry. We're talking about, 200, and we're talking geological time here, 250,000 years, when, of course, all humankind will be extinct. And everyone, like you, relieved and laughed in a sort of somewhat manic way, and except for this woman in the front row who got up and waved her program. She had clearly lunched extremely well, and said, what? She said, what do you mean? Even Americans will be extinct? So I'm afraid they will be extinct when the Atlantic ceases to be. We also know, or at least geological futurists, who are mathematicians largely based at the University of Texas, have worked out when they think it'll cease to be, which is in about another 170 million years' time. And what's going to happen, once again, I don't want to be too boringly technical about this, but what will happen is that Cape Horn on the southern tip of South America will start to move eastwards along the bottom, as it were, of the South Atlantic Ocean, will pass south of Cape of Good Hope and Cape Agulhas, and then pass south of Australia, and then start moving northwards by the time it gets to Tasmania, will set Australia spinning, very, very slowly, of course, in an anti-clockwise direction, and it, Cape Horn, if you're still with me, will move northwards and will eventually collide with Singapore. It's a bizarre thought, but that's what most futurologists think will happen. And when that occurs in 170 million years' time, then Africa and South America and Europe and North America will all have come together and the water will be squeezed out of the Atlantic. There's a finite amount of water on the planet, so it'll go somewhere else. There'll be other oceans, but the Atlantic that we know and love will have disappeared, will have had, therefore, a lifespan of about, from its birth 190 million years ago to its death 170 million years, time will be about, give or take, about 400 million years, a pretty respectable length of life. So that seemed to me to be to offer the structure. It has a birth, it has a life, it has a death, so biography is the answer. So the initial working title of the book was going to be Atlantic, the biography of an ocean. We wondered whether it should be a biography of the ocean, but we decided in the end, and I might say parenthetically, that the title that the book now has, which I think is in the programs, which is Great Sea Battles, Titanic Storms, Heroic Discoveries, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories, has absolutely nothing to do with me at all. What it has to do with is the buyer at Barnes & Noble, who says a biography of the ocean, or even the biography of an ocean, is far too prosaic or complicated a title for our customers. So it's got to be something much sexier than that. And we rolled our eyes, and they said, you know, it's got to have something about storms, something about battles. Anyway, this long portmanteau title, almost, or subtitle, almost as long as the book itself, is Barnes & Noble's, his fault, not mine. However, that gives the basic structure, the proscenium arch, if you like. But the central story... this is not a book about, totally about, anyway, the physical nature of the sea. It's about humankind and our relationship with the ocean. We occupy a very small period of time, about 200,000 years maximum, more or less in the middle of the 400 million years. And so complicated is our relationship with the ocean that it's not amenable to this same biological, biographical structure. So I had to come up with another idea. And it was complicated. I didn't quite know how to do it. But then I was sitting on a plane, much as I came back from London on Sunday last, and exactly the same, I'm always, you know, way in the back of the plane. I should say, I've scanned it to make sure he's not here. He's not. My publisher was also in the plane, but he was in first class, of course. Scriveners are right in the back. And I was pinioned on, I think it was 40A, and looking out, in this case, on the port side of the aircraft. But the moment I'm just going to describe to you was about 2 years ago when I was thinking, how am I going to come up with a structure for the Atlantic book? And I carried with me on Sunday, and I had carried with me 2 years ago, a book of poetry, which I'm sure you have in this library. It's an anthology compiled by David Owen, who was the former British Foreign Secretary, who's now called Lord Owen. And I had picked this up to read because, frankly, crossing the Atlantic is a really boring experience. When you do it by aeroplane, as most of us who cross it these days do, I mean, you've had your execrable meal, your neighbor is tedious to distraction, the movies are not worth watching, and whenever you press that little moving map in the screen in front of you, you are always, it seems to me, always somewhere between the southern tip of Greenland and Newfoundland and simply not moving at all. And the Atlantic Ocean is just an inconvenient mass of distance, this grey thing underneath. And I think part of the reason for writing the book was to try and remind people it's actually not. It's a lot more interesting than that. So I picked up David's book to read it, and the book is called Seven Ages, because he had decided, when he was in his late 60s, I think, to organize all the poetry that he loved through his life according to the seven ages of man from Shakespeare's As You Like It. And you remember All the World's a Stage and All the Men and Women Merely Players, they have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, the number of acts being seven ages. And those seven ages are, as I'm sure you'll all remember from school, the infant, you know, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, the schoolboy with shining morning face creeping unwillingly to school like snail, the lover, the soldier, the justice, the old man, and finally return to second childhood. He had organized his poetry like that, and I thought in a flash, as I was sitting watching this little plane move slowly between Greenland and Newfoundland, that possibly I could organize everything that I was beginning to learn about the Atlantic Ocean in these seven categories as well. And it all seemed to work, at least in theory, pretty well. For instance, if I took the soldier chapter, that could be everything relating to sort of military unpleasantness in the Atlantic Ocean. It could be everything from, you know, the first Viking raids to the boats that rammed each other to warfare between ships with cannons, wooden ships, metal-clad, you know, the evolution, you the Merrimack and the Monitor during the Civil War, and then the great battles like Trafalgar and the Battle of Jutland, but it could, and the Falklands War, which I was rather intimately involved in as well. And it would also look at things like piracy and slavery, so that was an obvious, easy category. If I looked at the lover, that could be everything relating to our romantic relationship with the Atlantic Ocean, so it could be the poetry and the paintings and the music, you know, Mendelssohn and Debussy and Beethoven, who all wrote music related to the Atlantic, and people like, well, from Dürer, one of the first people to have the Atlantic Ocean in one of his paintings, or one of his drawings, actually. And then, you know, people like J.M.W. Turner and Winslow Homer, of course, here in America. So that all seemed to work. And so that's how I did it, a biographical outer shell, as it were. And then, thanks to Shakespeare, who had never been to sea, never been on the Atlantic Ocean, never been on a ship, as far as we know, nonetheless, unwittingly, but proving once again his genius and his ability to relate to all aspects of our modern lives, gave me the structure. And the book has now been out for 3 months, I think, and I was terribly worried lest some of the fiercer critics would say, how dare this fellow Winchester use a Shakespearean model to write about the Atlantic Ocean, but no one was unkind. People were slightly unkind in other ways, but this structure we've dodged the bullet. So what I thought I'd do was to just to pluck almost at random from this great sort of gallimaufry of stories that I'd tried to corral into these seven categories, three specific stories, one from the North Atlantic, one from, well, sort of the North Atlantic again, and then one from the South Atlantic, to illustrate the sort of range of aspects of human life which are touched by or which are related to the ocean. The first story is utterly without any point at all, but it is vaguely amusing, as I hope you think. The second story is extremely important, but a lot of people don't know it, and I was surprised when I discovered it. And the last story is just frankly ludicrous. But and then I'll tell you about the book in Chile. Well, the first story, and these are all places that I went to do the research, is something that I came across in the Faroe Islands. The Faroe Islands are quintessentially Atlantic islands. They're in the far north Atlantic, about 60 degrees north, between Iceland and the Shetland Islands. There are 18 rather small islands. They are under Danish sovereignty, so there's a Danish governor. And they have a population of about 50,000 people whose livelihood is almost entirely derived from farming or fishing or whale hunting. They actually are allowed to hunt for a small quota of pilot whales. And they are essentially Vikings. I mean, the language, Faroese language, is the last extant relics of a language which is very similar to what the Vikings spoke. Well, we all know what the Vikings are famous or infamous for. I mean, sacking and rape and pillaging, all those nasty things. Well, the trouble with these Vikings is that they have no one to fight with. I mean, no one has been at war with the Faroes since the year Dot, as far as one can see. And so all the young men who are big and burly and look like Vikings have no one to fight with. And so they are cursed with or blessed with a superabundance of testosterone. And they need to do something which purges them of this excess. And what they do, I'll describe to you. The makeup of these 18 islands, they're all made of basalt, horizontal basalt, much like East Greenland and Iceland, of course. But the thing about the Faroes is that the basalt is tilted about, I suppose, about 30 degrees from west to east, which results in, on the western side of each of these 18 little islands, there are huge cliffs, very, I mean, some of the tallest cliffs in the world. And then there's a grassy top, and it slopes down at about 30 degrees until you get to the eastern side, which is completely, it just bleeds into the sea. So the events that I'm going to describe take place on these cliffs. And the island where I first saw this was an island called Mykinesh, which is actually the most westerly of the 18 islands. And when you see the cliffs from the sea, I mean, they're startling. They're vertical. They're jet black. They're covered with torrents of water cascading down them, and rocks and things are falling off them. But if you look carefully, you'll see peppered along the black lines of the basalt very small areas, about as big as that circular table, of grass, but vertiginously steep little patches of grass. And this is where the action takes place. If you look closely at each of the cliffs, or certainly on Mykinesh and most of the other islands, you'll see that there are fixed ropes which extend from the summit, where there are big stanchions hammered into the grass at the top, all the way down to the sea. And what happens is that each spring, in about March or April, young Faroese men, young Viking men, will come to the bottom of the cliffs with the intention of climbing to the top, using these fixed ropes. And you can imagine it's a very difficult thing to get from the boat to the bottom of the cliffs, because the water's going up and down, the terrific waves, and the bottom of the cliff covered with eelgrass and seaweed. It's very slippery, very sharp and dangerous rocks. And of course, if you fall into the sea, I mean, you just, well, maybe you could swim, but the water's very cold. Everything about it is miserable and dangerous. But nonetheless, the chaps come to the bottom of the cliffs, and they find the rope that they want to use for the climb, and they, timing the moment accurately, they make a well-practiced leap over the waves, grab onto a rope, and with luck and judgment and experience, they survive it, and they're there at the bottom of the cliff, at the bottom, hanging onto the rope. Before he begins his climb, each man reaches back down into the well of the boat, and from it, he retrieves a lamb, because there are lots of lambs in the bottom of the boat. And these lambs, rather bewildered an animal, he snugs it round his neck. He doesn't put a rope or a string round his neck, but he manages somehow to put his collar such that the lamb, with his little legs dangling down his chest, is securely positioned around his neck. And then once he's confident that the lamb isn't going to fall off, he begins his climb. And he goes up 100 feet, 200 feet, 400 feet, up into the clouds, way, way up, until maybe 800 or 1,000 feet up, when the little boat and everything is tiny, he comes to a patch of grass which he thinks is suitable for his purpose. Well, I should say the thing about the grass is that it's fertilized by the guano from the seabirds that inhabit the cliffs, kittiwakes and guillemots and things like that, but most notably of all, puffins. And I'm sure you all know that puffin guano is extremely rich in nutrients, and the result of this is that the grass is extremely lush and delicious to eat. The only slight inconvenience is that it is an angle of about 80 degrees from the horizontal. It is hardly a meadow or a pasture we're talking about, but nonetheless, this does not deter our Viking, because what he does when he's up alongside one of these patches of grass, he takes the lamb from his shoulder and plants it on the grass. And of course, the first time, I don't know if lambs experience terror, but if he looks down, he will see the sea crawling a fifth of a mile below him. But very solicitously, the Viking sort of props it up until the lamb realizes that if he's going to survive, he's got to plant his feet in a certain manner such that he's stable. And it takes 4 or 5 minutes, apparently, each time to do this, but there comes a moment where, and the Viking, the Faroese chap, is talking to the animal in I don't know what language, in lamb or Viking, but anyway, saying things like, you're going to be all right, don't worry, I'm with you, I'm not going to let you go. And then there comes this moment where the lamb clearly can stand on its own, whereupon he removes his hand and the lamb stays where it is, and he climbs down the rope and goes and joins his chums and rows back to wherever he started off from. And this is the scene that you see in the Faroe Islands during the late spring and the summer, the great black walls of these cliffs, these little patches of steep, vertiginous grass, and a little white dot in the middle of each one where there is a lamb, terrified to distraction, but munching happily on this wonderful puffin guano fertilized grass and learning how to live with his somewhat precarious situation. Come September, October, the reverse, and this we saw too, the reverse takes place. The same chap comes back to the same rope and shins up it 200, 400, 600, 800 feet until he reaches his patch of grass to be confronted no longer by a lamb, but by an enormous and very fat sheep that has spent the whole summer eating, I won't say merrily, but eating anyway, and not doing any exercise whatsoever, and just being terrified of falling off. I would love to be able to tell you that the Faroese man is compassionate and puts the animal on his shoulders and climbs down with it, but he's not. He is, after all, a Viking. And what he does is, instead of putting his hand on the outside of the sheep, he puts it on the inside between the sheep and the mountain, and with a quick and well-practiced jerk, he moves it backwards, and the sheep falls down 1,000 feet, crashes into the water, where he's usually not very well indeed. And indeed, I'm sure many of you remember Monty Python and the sketches about the possibilities of ovine aviation. It is a very dangerous thing to do, to be at the bottom of Faroese cliffs in September or October because of the danger of falling sheep. But anyway, the Faroese chap gets to the bottom, gets back into his boat, and with a boat hook, he pulls in the sheep, because the wool keeps them floating for quite a long time, pulls it into the boat and takes it back to Tórshavn, the capital, where it is butchered, and it is said to be the sweetest and most tender lamb on the face of the planet. So there we are. The story has no point to it at all, but so it's just a small illustration of the kind of things that go on in the Atlantic Ocean. The second story is much more serious, not solemn, but nonetheless serious. And it's some of you may well know the history. First, a bit of background. It's to do with the Battle of the Atlantic. There were two battles of the Atlantic, fought in one in each of the two world wars. And I'm, in this case, talking about the summer of 1916. And Britain was at that time losing the Battle of the Atlantic. In both cases, these were what were known as tonnage wars, where German submarines, U-boats, attempted to interdict and sink eastbound cargo ships, which were bringing supplies from this country and from Canada to beleaguered Britain. And in the major difference between the First and the Second World War prosecution of this kind of warfare was that in the First World War, German technology did not allow the submarine captains to fire their torpedoes while their boats were submerged. They always had to use their periscopes to find where the cargo ships were, and once they had located them, they would come to the surface, then fire their torpedoes. But by coming to the surface, they made themselves vulnerable to attack by the escort destroyers or corvettes or frigates that the British, the Allies, were using to protect the convoy. And so 1914, 15, 16, the British were doing very well and were defeating German submarines and sending them to the bottom. But then suddenly this ability to do this suddenly was compromised by a simple and rather bizarre fact that our guns, the Royal Navy's guns, were stopping their ability to fire because we were running out of cordite, the propellant that propelled the shell out of the gun. And we were running out of cordite because Britain, corporately, was running out of a crucial chemical component of cordite, which was the chemical called acetone, which many ladies will know here as the basis of nail polish remover. So that was the problem that we were faced with in the summer of 1916, that Britain had run out of acetone. We had always bought it from Germany, but clearly Germany wasn't going to be selling us acetone during World War I to help us sink their submarines. So we'd run out of it, and we didn't basically know what to do. So that's the background. The story involves the editor, the then editor of the Manchester Guardian, the paper that I used to work for, a chap called C.P. Scott, who's revered in journalistic circles to this day because he was the man that said, comment is free, but facts are sacred. He was a legendary journalistic exemplar of the goodness of the craft. And he used to have lunch every Tuesday at the Northern Liberal Club with someone that he found interesting. And one day in late July or early August 1916, the person that he decided to have lunch with was the professor of biology at the University of Manchester, who was a white Russian immigré called Chaim Weizmann. And he had this long lunch, and they discussed all manner of things, but towards the end of the lunch, Weizmann said in a very excited way, "Oh, Mr. Scott, by the way, I have in my laboratory in Manchester come up with a technique to produce acetone in very large quantities." Now, C.B. Scott had never heard of the word acetone in his life, didn't know what this fellow was talking about, but was intelligent enough to realize this was important, and he stored away the fact in his mind. Well, the next week, his Tuesday lunch was not in Manchester, but it was in London, and he was having lunch with David Lloyd George, who at the time was Minister of War Munitions. And Lloyd George was going on and on about what I had just told you earlier, that the Royal Navy was having terrible difficulties in the Atlantic because we had run out of cordite, because we had run out of acetone. And a light went on in Scott's head, and he said, "Well, I met this funny little fellow last week who claims that he can make acetone in very large quantities. I have no idea what he's talking about, but he seemed, you know, to be sensible." And Lloyd George said, "Well, this is wonderful. We must have him down. We must send the boffins up to interview him." And so he was brought down to London and was declared to be, you know, sane and all the rest of it. And they said to him, "Well, Professor Weizmann, what do you need?" And he said, "Well, I need a large disused factory, something that's got, you know, vats or stills or hoppers or something like that." And they said, "Well, as it happens, the Nicholson's Gin Factory in Bow in East London, where Bow Bells are, that's just gone into receivership and the British government owns it. So would a gin factory work?" And he said, "Gin factory, absolutely wonderful, just what I need. And what else do you need?" And he said, "Well, basically I need a very large supply of something with a lot of cellulose. So maize, perhaps. Do you have maize?" And they said, "Well, no, you can't have any maize because that all comes from North America and is being torpedoed by the Germans. So that's the problem we're trying to solve. We've run out of it." And he said, "What about chestnuts?" Well, this was now September 1916, and you may know that in Britain, I think it's also played in this country, but less enthusiastically, there is a game that all boy children in Britain are programmed from birth to play called Conkers. What you do is you pick horse chestnuts and you take off the skin, and there's this shiny brown nut which you bore a hole through with a skewer stolen from your mother. You suspend it on a string like a plumb bob, and one little boy similarly armed attempts to break yours. It's a nasty game. A lot of cheating is involved and injuries and things, but enormous fun. And every little boy in Britain picks Conkers up. I think it's called Killer in this country, isn't it? But maybe it's only in New England or somewhere. Anyway, there was, therefore, this vast volunteer army of children who could scour Conkers or chestnuts from every corner of the land, and it was decided to employ them to collect these things for Professor Weizmann. And so the word went out that children that year, sure, as usual, they should collect Conkers, but they should not play the game. They should give them to their mothers, who would put them in bags, and wait for lorries to turn up, which they indeed did, put these little bags of Conkers into sacks, and the lorries would all come down to London, converging in their hundreds on the Nicholson's Gin Factory, where they were poured into the vats of the distillery, and using Professor Weizmann's magic, after the process was duly installed, first a trickle, then a stream, then a torrent of pure acetone came out of the spigots at the bottom. It was put into carboys, loaded onto railway trains, taken down to Poole in Dorset in the west of England, the Naval Ordnance Munitions Factory, where it was turned into cordite, which was taken out to the waiting ships. The guns started firing again, and the whole metric of the war changed in October, November, December 1916, that far from losing the war to the Germans, the submarines were now being sunk again, and Britain could say, we are winning the Battle of the Atlantic. Well, and that trend continued throughout the spring to the point where in about May 1917, the British government felt really smug about the way the war was going, and they had a meeting, and they said essentially, you know, this is all due to this funny little fellow that we met in Manchester. They're not very imaginative, the Brits, in rewarding people for their efforts. They said, we must give him a knighthood. He's got this strange name, Chaim, or Chaim, they didn't quite know how to pronounce it, but Sir Chaim Weizmann, it sounds rather nice. But then they discovered a wrinkle, that he wasn't actually British, he was White Russian. And so he couldn't be properly given a knighthood, but he could be given an honorary knighthood, but that would have to be bestowed on him initially, at least the offer would have to be made, by the British Foreign Secretary, who was Arthur Balfour. So Balfour, who'd never heard of this fellow, well, that's not true, actually, they knew each other socially, so I shouldn't have said that. He had him down from Manchester and sat him in his office in the great ambassador's waiting room in the Foreign Office and said to him, this memorable moment, Professor Weizmann, on behalf of His Majesty's government, I would like to, out of gratitude for the way you have participated in changing the direction of the war, I would like to make you an offer of a knighthood. You can call yourself, it's an honorary knighthood, you can call yourself Sir Chaim Weizmann. And Weizmann said, with considerable dignity, he said, that's terribly nice of you, Lord Balfour, but I don't want a knighthood. You know me very well as the secretary of the English Zionist League. And what I would like from you and your government is a formal declaration that your government would welcome the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. And Arthur Balfour said, I think we should talk about that. And so the whole summer, this was debated until November, I believe it was the 17th, 1917, this famous document, the Balfour Declaration, that His Majesty's government looks with favour upon the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine, was issued, formally sent to the President of the World Zionist Congress, Lord Rothschild, but with a copy made out of gratitude to the man who brought it about in the first place, Chaim Weizmann, Professor of Biology at Manchester University. And then, 31 years later, there was born, on the strength, on the back of the Balfour Declaration, was born the State of Israel. So one can legitimately say that Israel came into being through an accident of chemistry, a want of a substance called acetone, nail polish remover, in the North Atlantic, a connection most people, I think, are unaware of. I don't know how many of you were, but anyway. And the final story, from the relatively sublime to the utterly ludicrous, moves down to the South Atlantic and to a little island. Once again, maybe some of you will have been there, passing cruise ships occasionally stop there, a place called Tristan da Cunha. I don't know if any of you have. Tristan da Cunha is a volcano. It's arguably the most isolated inhabited island in the world. It's a British colonial possession still. We still have an empire of sorts. It's 1,800 miles due west of Cape Town. It's miserable beyond belief. It has a population of about 260 people who live in a tiny community called Edinburgh of the Seven Seas, where they fish rather unsuccessfully and raise potatoes. And what they do with each other, they do with each other, with predictable genetic consequences. There are seven families, and they, I won't go into it in detail, but they're not the sharpest tools in the shed, let us say. But they're sharp enough to know that where they live is, by their lights, a sort of a paradise, because The volcano erupted in 1962 and the entire population was evacuated to an army base near Southampton in England, and they hated it. They'd never seen motor cars before, they'd never seen lifts or elevators and things like that, and the crowding and the bustle. And after a year, they said, well, thank you to the British government for being so kind, but we all want to go home. And they all did go home, and they've been there in, you know, contented isolation ever since. Well, in 1941, the British government, for reasons best known to itself, reclassified the island of Tristan da Cunha as a ship. They renamed it HMS Atlantic Isle and said that it was a ship with, and I don't mean to sound obsessively interested in submarines, it was a static ship from which naval officers would patrol the South Atlantic to watch for German U-boats. And so they dismissed the colonial governor, and in his place they sent down a naval party to captain the ship. And the person they chose to captain it was a young lieutenant called Derek Boy, spelt B-O-O-Y. And he, with six naval ratings, ran this ship for the duration of the war. Well, during these 6 years, in the tradition of sailors and girls, he fell in love. At least he believes he fell in love with one of the island girls called Emily Rogers. He wrote a book about it in the 1950s, and it was the most restrained love affair you can imagine. There are two episodes which essentially mark the high point of the romance. One where he believes that when he said hello to her, she replied, hello. But he thinks that, I mean, the words were whipped away by the wind, but he was almost certain. And on the day that, at the end of the war, when the naval party left, there's a very, very tender scene where all the women from the island were lined up on the beach to give their farewells to the departing sailors. And he was terribly miserable because Emily, he didn't want to leave. Maybe he thought the conversation would progress beyond hello. He wasn't exactly the fastest worker in the world, but nonetheless. But he saw the young women were sitting on chairs on the beach and the older women were standing behind them. And he couldn't see terribly well because of the foam and also a sort of mist in his eyes. I think he had tears in his eyes. But he swears that as he was waving, he saw one young woman, they were all wearing headscarves, bow her head, and one of the older women patted her to give her comfort. And that convinced him that A, this was Emily, and B, she definitely was in love with him. So he went back to England and assumed other duties and was never back in touch with her, but did write this book in the 1950s, and I was very moved by this account. So I wrote a book in the mid-1980s about all the relics of the British Empire, one of which was Tristan. So I went to Tristan. One of the things I wanted to do was to meet Emily. Now, that had all taken place in the 1940s. This was 40 years on, so Emily was now 60-odd. And she had married. She had married the chief islander, so she was now Emily Swain. And I went and interviewed all sorts of other people, and then I walked up to the chief islander's cottage, and there was the chief islander standing with a sort of menacing aspect to him, with folded arms by his garden gate, and he said, "You're a writer." And I said, "Yes, I am, I'm afraid." And he said, "I imagine you'll want to speak to our Emily." And I said, "Well, I'd very much like to." And he said, "No." I said, "Why not? Because of that disgusting book." I said, "But it was a charming book. I mean, it was two lines about the possibility, about Emily saying hello. I mean, it wasn't exactly, you know, Harold Robbins. And she said, "No, it was disgusting. I don't wish that to be thought about. Emily has been married to me for the last 40 years, and any thoughts of her having had a past, I just don't want it repeated." So I said, "All right," and retreated and came back to, I forget where I was living at the time, but I duly wrote a book in which the Tristan chapter appears, and a tiny little paragraph in the middle of this tiny little chapter refers to Derek Boy and his possible dalliance with a much younger Emily. Well, in 1995 or so, I was on a cruise ship in the South Atlantic lecturing on the islands of the South Atlantic to a group of American travelers. And we went to the Falkland Islands and South Georgia and many of the islands off the Antarctic coast, and eventually came to Tristan. And I gave this long and very discursive lecture, because it has a fascinating history, which I haven't obviously talked about tonight. So there was the island. You see it. I mean, it's very dramatic, the approaches to Tristan. It's this exquisitely shaped volcano, and we're maybe 20 miles away and steaming towards it about 10 knots. So getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I'm talking about its role in the Napoleonic Wars and volcano and all this sort of thing. And then finally I finish the lecture and we drop anchor, and the boat comes out to collect the American passengers and to take them for the first time in their lives to the most isolated island in the world. But I noticed, somewhat to my alarm, that one of the islanders in the boat had the helmet of the Tristan police force on. I mean, there's only one policeman, there's no crime or like that. And he came on board, and first thing he said was, "Is there a Mr. Winchester on board this ship?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Well, I'm afraid you're not going to be allowed to visit." And I said, "Why not?" He said, "It was that disgusting book you wrote." But I said, "I was, by now 1990, I mean, Emily is in her 70s or 75, I think." And but I said, well, I spluttered, and I said, "Well, no, I'm not going to create a fuss. Okay, I've been there, and it's not that interesting. It's just potatoes, basically." And so all the Americans, who were, a lot of them were lawyers, and said things like "sue" and "freedom of speech" and "how dare they?" But they all trooped on, and I just sat on the in the bridge, feeling very embarrassed. I mean, it was not a nice position to be put in. And they then all came back and said, "You know, it's really boring, and here's a potato as a souvenir," that sort of thing. And I thought no more about it. I was just sort of chagrined. And the same thing happened. I went back in 1999, I think, and then in 2001. And each time I was not allowed to land. So when I was doing research for this book, I needed to go again to do the sort of definitive, to put Tristan in its Atlantic perspective. So this time I wrote to the British governor. Well, actually, he's called the administrator. And he's a nice man. I'd known him previously in Pakistan, and he has email. So I was able to email him, and I said, "David, I'm thinking of coming down in January, and as you know, I've got a bit of a problem." And he wrote back, and he said, "My wife and I are so excited. You know, the last time, we went trekking in Ladakh or somewhere, and it'd be lovely to see you again, and we can have tea, and it'd be super. But you do have a problem. And I'll have to put it formally to the island council." By this time, Emily and her husband were both dead. So I would have thought the possibility of the libel had been long purged, but this was not to be the case. Because back came the formal declaration that it has been decided by the island council that Mr. Winchester will not be allowed to visit Tristan da Cunha on this occasion, or indeed ever. So I am banned from Tristan da Cunha. And I'm sorry that in this account of the Atlantic, which I hope to otherwise to be discursive and comprehensive, there is a lacuna, for which I apologize, and I hope I've explained myself. Well, finally, I want to get back to the book that I read in that library in Punta Arenas. It was a book which is a little difficult to get hold of, although you can actually get it online, a PDF. It's by a man called John Marsh, and it's called Skeleton Coast. And it's, I don't know if any of you have been to the Skeleton Coast, but it is a stretch of about 300 miles in southwest Africa between the Cunene River in Angola and central Namibia. And the problem with the Skeleton Coast is that if any ship strands on it, and there are ferocious onshore currents, there's a razor-sharp reefs, there's fog, all sorts of navigational hazards, and no water. If you strand, you die. You die of thirst. And indeed, the place is called the Skeleton Coast because there it is littered with the carcasses of ships that have come to grief there. Well, the story that John Marsh wrote was of one shipwreck that didn't end up quite like that. It was in 1942, in November, a ship called the Dunedin Star, which was a refrigerated cargo ship, coming down from Liverpool with 62 passengers on it, including two young babies. And it was going round up to Aden, round the coast of South Africa, but it hit a reef called the Clan Alpine Shoal, and did indeed strand on this ferocious, very, very dangerous coastline. Everyone got off, they built themselves a shelter, and they waited to die, basically. But he had managed, the captain, to send out an SOS, and the South Africans, or the British in South Africa, knew all about it, and they sent boats up in an attempt to rescue them. All of them were beaten back, two of them sank. In the end, they decided the way to rescue them was to do something which had never been attempted before, which was to send a convoy of Land Rovers overland, over the desert. It took 2 months to get to them. They, every day, Hercules, or bomber, not Hercules, but Lancaster bombers, would drop motorcar tires filled with water to the people down below. And so they lived, and eventually, after this incredible expedition, which really I found utterly gripping, they were rescued, and no one died, and they all got back to South Africa and then to London quite safely. There were, however, two deaths, and that was on a ship, a little tugboat called the Sir Charles Elliot, which came up to attempt to rescue them by sea from Cape Town. And there were two young men who decided to try and swim ashore and fix a rope to the shore. And one was called, he was a Namibian, or those days a Southwest African, called Matthias Coriseb. And the other was a Scotsman called Angus Campbell McIntyre. And both of them drowned. They found Matthias Coriseb's body, but they never found Angus Campbell McIntyre. Well, I was very moved by this whole story, and I decided that I wanted to go there to see if I could find the wreck of the ship and also to find the grave, what must be the loneliest grave in the world, to these two heroic young men. So I found myself in Cape Town, and I got up to Windhoek, and I took a tiny little plane way up into the Skeleton Coast and found a man there with a Land Rover, and we went up. I had the GPS coordinates of the Dunedin Stars wreck, and eventually we found it. I mean, I won't go into the details. Quite a lot of the stories in the book. And it was quite extraordinary. We suddenly, in the middle of nowhere, in this desert, no water, of course, except the pounding sea on the left, there was the funnel, and there were the boilers, and there was the rudder, and there was the anchor, and there were the boxes of cargo, which I opened, and they were unbroken light bulbs from made in Britain in the 1940s. Of course, there was nowhere to plug them in and see if they worked, but they were at least were they were whole, as it were. And then, and the shelter was still there, the shelter that they had built. The canvas had been ripped away in the gales, but the wooden spars were still there. And then I decided to go down to the grave, which was about 12 miles further south at a place called Rocky Point. And if you go to Rocky Point and you stand on the point, in the dips between the big rollers coming in, you can occasionally see two black pieces of iron, which are stanchions from the Sir Charles Elliot, which is all that remains above the surface of this boat, which is steadily being broken up. And opposite that, exactly, that was the guide marker for this, there's this little gravestone. There's a brass plaque, and there's just a huge pile of whale bones and boulders and things. And it says, this is raised to the memory of Matthias Coriseb and Angus Campbell McIntyre, who died in an attempt to rescue people from the Dunedin Star in November 1942. Well, I was tremendously moved by this. Coriseb's body had been found, but it struck me that Angus Campbell McIntyre somehow symbolized our human relationship with this great body of water. He was born on an Atlantic island in western Scotland. He traveled down the Atlantic Ocean to take a job in Cape Town, which is one of the great cities of the Atlantic Ocean. He worked on a tug, all of whose business was ferrying or tugging ships in and out of the Atlantic Ocean. And then he died trying to effect a rescue on the Atlantic, and his body lies somewhere now in the Atlantic. So it struck me that he was a very symbolically important figure. So I had found a little bottle at the wreck site, the kind of thing that I imagine a woman passenger had kept, you know, smelling salts or sal volatile or something, worn smooth by the sand, little screw top. And it sounds awfully sappy, I know, but I tore a page out of my notebook and I simply said, "Thank you for trying, now rest in peace." And I signed it and folded it up and put it in it seemed a message in a bottle, just an appropriate thing to do. And there is this Scottish tradition too, if you get a cairn, a pile of boulders, you add something to it to add to its structural integrity so that it lasts even longer. So I took this and a stone that I found, and I put the two of them on top of the pile, and I just left it there in the hope that this was, you know, a small personal thank you to this chap. But then when I got back to New York and started writing the book, I thought that it would be even more appropriate to do something that was possibly going to last even longer, and that was to dedicate the book to him. And so in the end, I decided that the book should be dedicated to my wife, Setsko, and also to the memory of Angus Campbell McIntyre, a man who, I think more than anyone else that I wrote about in this book, symbolizes our relationship with this great, gray, heaving body of water, the Atlantic Ocean. So thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Of course, I'd be delighted to try and answer any questions about this or any other book, so please fire away if you want to.
Do you have a favorite book?
A favorite book of the ones I've written? Well, it used to be I'd written a book about the Yangtze River called The River at the Center of the World. I love China. And that used to be my favorite, but do you know, oddly enough, I, it's going to sound a terribly conceited thing to say, but I really like this book. It seems I had this most amazing experience on Saturday. I came back from London on Sunday, and there was a copy at home of the Saturday Wall Street Journal. And I love doing acrostic crossword puzzles, the ones that appear every other week in the New York Times magazine and every week now in the Wall Street Journal. And as you know, these acrostics is a sentence or a paragraph from a book, which you can determine by filling out answers to a number of clues. And I was attracted to this puzzle because all the clues were maritime questions. You know, what was found 370 miles southeast of St. John's, Newfoundland? And of course, it's Titanic. So you put TITANIC, and then you distribute those letters in the matrix. And the weird thing was, and at first I thought it was jet lag, but I started seeing, it's like seeing a face through the mist and you suddenly recognize it. The piece of text that was in this box was text from my book. So it's never happened to me before. I'm sure it'll never happen again. But they had chosen a part of this book. And the trouble was, I couldn't remember it, so I had to actually solve the crossword. But in the end, I got it. Sir? Yes, my word. Oh, it's horrible. I mean, it's new brutalism writ large in the middle of India. But I should say, all I did for that book was to take the photographs. I was living in India at the time. The text is written by Jan Morris, it's a lovely, lovely book. I didn't do much business. It's now, I think, reprinted in paperback. But it meant that I could spend, I spent about a year wandering all about India, taking photographs of railway stations and post offices and what we as imperialists had left behind. And we left a lot of lovely things, wonderful churches and clubs and things, but that is not, I wish you hadn't chosen it. It's not desperately, no. I mean, it reminds me of that church at Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza, the Catholic church next to the Japan Society. Ouch. There are lovelier churches in India. St. Mary's Cathedral, Calcutta, for instance. Right, okay. Well, let us, anyway, civil differences here. Thank you, sir. Thank you. I'm sorry. Yes. Oh, the way I work. Golly, well, I'll tell you In fact, I'll tell you a story from Calcutta, oddly enough. Where, this illustrates it rather nicely. Mercifully, most of you in this room will remember telex. I mean, telex, you talk to a youngster, they have no idea what telex is. But telex was our, to those of us who were foreign correspondents, and that's what I was for most of my life, telex was our connection to home. And at the time of this story, it was my first big break as a foreign correspondent. I was based in Belfast, but it was a relatively quiet period, and they decided to send me to Calcutta, this was 1970, to report on the war that then led to the establishment of Bangladesh. So we were based in the Grand Hotel in Calcutta, and every day we established a routine. You'd go out to the front, and you'd watch these enormous tank battles. And the wonderful thing was that the Pakistani tank commanders had gone to Sandhurst, as had the Indian tank commanders. And so Sonny Mater would say, I know what that fellow is going to be doing because we were taught in the same battle. So the battles had a sort of ludicrous aspect to them, but they were lethal and people died and Bangladesh was created as a result. But anyway, we then came back to the hotel and there were two telex machines and there were maybe 12 of us. Journalism was different in those days. That there were a smaller number of relatively knowledgeable people. I wasn't, because I'd just come from Ireland, but there were grandees of Eastern journalism who had covered India and Asia for a long time. And so we'd all type up frantically our copy, and you'd wind this yellow strand of maybe hundreds of yards of tape around your hand. So every journalist was wandering around the lobby of the hotel with what looked like a great mitten of punched tape around his fingers, waiting for a line to open to London, because there was no question that you could just, you know, do international direct dialing. I mean, now you ring Calcutta, you get through in 5 seconds. But in those days, you had to book a call, and because the line was of such dreadful quality and the connections were made so seldom, the agreement between all 12 of us was whenever we reached one Western newspaper, whether it was the New York Times here or whether it was the Guardian in London or the BBC, we'd offload all the copy, all 12 stories, and get them, the distant wire room, to redistribute them. There was a sort of camaraderie, and everyone agreed that this was what should be done. So if you can imagine us, we're tired, we're battle-weary, as it were. We just want to get our stories sent to London and go to bed or go and have dinner or whatever. Waiting for one of these machines to hum into life. They're dark, nothing's happening. Then suddenly, one of the machines does light up. And as one, all 12 of us crane over to look at what was it was called the answer back. In other words, what distant office was calling us? Would it be nytimes.u, which was New York Times USA, or would it be Guardian G, which was my newspaper? It wasn't any of these. I realized to my horror that it was my father's office in London. And obviously it was late at night and he was doing it one letter at a time. Mother and I greatly enjoying stories you sending from India. Particularly liked the use of the verb such and such in paragraph. And I'm thinking, for God's sake. And then it ended. Obviously he got these senior journalists were furious, saying, get this man off. And finally it ended, and it said, and finally, comma, Simon, comma, mother says, while in India, take care to keep off the salads. And then he cut it off. So it's a very long way of saying that technology has changed enormously. But yet I miss those days. I think I ought to go to this side because I'm going to get into terrible trouble.
I very much enjoyed your book, The Man Who Loves China, which I read some time ago. I wondered if you ever met the Chinese.
Sadly, no. I mean, Joseph Needham died in 1995, and I didn't even know about him until a bookseller in Salisbury, Connecticut, upbraided me for not ever having heard of Science and Civilization in China, this massive book. But he sold me a copy. It was when I was doing the Yangtze book, oddly enough, and I needed to know something about the design of sailing junks that went between Chongqing and Wuhan. And he sold me this book. And he said it's part of a series of 20-odd volumes of the longest book in the English language ever written about China. And I sat in the car looking at this 964 pages. I'm sure you have it in the Society Library. All devoted to China's relationship with water. And it was everything from lock gates to rudder design to the design of the boats that operated between Chongqing and Wuhan to canal construction to navigation to lighthouses. And I thought to myself, if this man wrote this book and 20 other volumes on astronomy and zoology and medicine and what have you, he just must be the most extraordinary man. Well, if you've read the book, you know how extraordinary he was. And but the answer to your question is no, I wish I had. I mean, he must be one of the most interesting people imaginable, but I never did meet him, no. Sir? Well, they come about in weird. Sometimes one book leads to another. I mean, I did this book about Joseph Smith, William Smith, rather, not Joseph Smith, it's a totally different character, who created the first geological map in the world. And that actually, you'd never think a book about sedimentary geology and map making would sell, but it actually did sell extremely well. And so the editor came to me and said, you know, you were a geologist, weren't you? You're obviously interested in what is the greatest geological event. And I just said, off the top of, I just said Krakatoa. And he said, good, write a book about Krakatoa. And then that led to the San Francisco earthquake. They sort of lead one to another. But the next book I'm doing is about America, largely because I've been coming to America since I first came here in 1963. So that'll be half a century in 2013. And I become a citizen this year. So I just want to sort of do a celebration because I love this country. For all its troubles at the moment, I still think it's, you know, the shining city on the hill and all the rest of it. And so I come up, which I hope is an interesting way to do it. And that's what I'll be doing. So that really came about because I've always wanted to write a book about America. But the others tend to, one follows another in a sort, with a sort of logic. At the back there, sir.
Planes were mysteriously vanished and boats were lost without a trace. And yet this whole mystery has sort of disappeared from my consciousness.
Well, it sort of disappeared from the, I think it's in the index, but very perfunctory mention is given to the, same with Atlantis. There is no answer, there's no statistical reality, but boats disappear with equal frequency in other parts. It's just that because of the Sargasso Sea and because of the volume of traffic and because of the exotica, it's just assumed quite unnecessarily a role in myth and legend, and I just think it bores me now. I'm sorry it doesn't bore you, but I didn't write about it. If you're looking for a book about the Bermuda Triangle, this is not it. Well, I mean, that... Believe you me, I one of the things I regret about the development of GPS technology is the disappearance of lighthouses. I adore lighthouses. There are some grand lighthouses in this book, and the Americans are decommissioning them at the rate of 60 a year, and that I think is awful. The, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson's family built some of the great lighthouses in the world, like Skerry Vore and Du Bartek, and they're all either automatic or being dismantled because of satellites, which I think is a retrograde step. Sir, behind him. Yes.
His impact, to compare
Well, I don't think it's irrational. I mean, after all, Leif Erikson built a settlement, and he actually got to the continent, which is more than Christopher Columbus did, and he sort of realized where he... No, I mean, the Asiatics. I'm married to a Japanese, so that's not a word I would use. But honestly, she would get rather cross. But, I mean, they came across by land. Of course I understand your point, but I want to give Leif Erikson a fair shake. I mean, he is forgotten. He should not be. He built a settlement. There was a child, the first European child, born in the Americas, was born at Lanso Meadows in Newfoundland in 1004 AD. He was called Snorri Thorfinnsson. I mean, you've got to be charmed by such a reality. Columbus imported pigs, he imported disease, he was a slaver, he was a villain in many ways, and he didn't get here. So I agree, the impact of Columbus's expeditions was profound, and I acknowledge that, but I want to... Well, I apologize, and I've admitted I will find it difficult to get reservations in fine Italian restaurants. So I gather we're going to an Italian restaurant. Maybe this is a plot. Maybe just let me see if there's anyone on this side. Could I defer possibly to you, ma'am? I know what you're talking about, of course, yes. Slocum, right. Yeah. Have you been to Sable Island? That would be. I think I would love to go. I've not either. But I mean, to me, Nova Scotia is a slice of heaven. And we were talking about it before the talk. Yeah. Congruent, of course, with Morocco. The geology, as you know. So, but no, I adore Nova Scotia. So, well, thank you. Maybe. Let's hope. Thank you. Right. Well, thank you all very much indeed. Thank you.
We do have books for sale, and Mr. Winchester will be at the front of the members' room. Thank you all for coming, and see you at our next event.